Can everybody hear each other?
Yep.
All right. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Enlightened Radio. You're listening to enlightenedradio.org. You probably know that. I've been playing jazz divas for the past 24 hours here.
Beautiful.
I found a collection of about 25 full concerts of people going all the way back from Julie London, which we just heard, to Etta James and all kinds of other people that haven't heard in a long time. Ella Fitzgerald, et cetera. But we're starting the Are You Crazy program here now, which is broadcasting on Tuesdays, roughly around 9 o'clock. We are starting a little bit late because Ari went to the closed...
call this program Are You Meshuggahna?
let me get your up. You need to be up a little bit. Try again.
1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4.
And so I want to welcome a former guest on the show several times, Ari Plost, who's a rabbi at, could you please name the synagogue that you're
sure,
at?
Sure, it's B'nai Abraham, or the Children of Abraham,
and
in Hagerstown.
And we've had a couple of conversations in the past, but I wanted to get a hold of Ari again, and as well as start a series with some other folks as well on dealing with hate. And since we've had a resurgence of it in numerous forums here recently, including the most recent event of the neo... I don't even know whether they're neo-Nazis or... whatever it is, very racist and fascist kinds of elements that decided to come out, you might say, to Charlottesville. But there's been many other incidents around the country that have arisen, especially in the wake of the recent elections. And so I wanted to have a discussion today, and hopefully Dr. McGill, who's also currently the president of the NAACP in Berkeley County, and see if we could begin a discussion here of what's behind the rise in hate activity, at least as... for example, has been documented by the Southern Poverty Law Center and other organizations, although I recently heard the right wings call the Southern Poverty Law Center itself a hate crime. See, that's how things get flip-flopped here. But anyway, let's...
Why not?
Yeah.
In the era of alternate facts.
Yeah, the alt-hate, whatever it is. But anyway, I know that since Ari has had some experience himself in this with this kind of issue, and the Jewish community in the area, I can't believe doesn't have some concerns as well, based on the long history of this kind of tendency here. But why don't we start with Dr. McGill? Why don't you? I like the way you usually start, asking our guests to introduce themselves and say a little bit about themselves for the record. Let me just also say we're going to be podcasting this episode here. This is September the 12th, right? And 2017. I'm revealing my age there. 2017. And we'll be putting this up on the enlightenedradio.org website here shortly after we're done today. But, Dr. McGill.
Good morning and welcome to the Are You Crazy show, Health and Wellness. And, I'm glad we take on this topic today about hate, because often people ask me, is bigotry or prejudice a mental illness? So maybe we'll get a chance to... get the rabbi to weigh in on that. But I want to welcome the rabbi to our show. And what we ask folks, our guests, often is to just paint a little portrait of yourself for our guests, for our listeners out there. Where you were born, where you grew up, and how'd you end up out here in the hinterlands? And how'd you get into theology, rabbinical work?
Well, first, let me just begin by saying how appreciative I am for the good work that both of you are doing, both at this moment through this lens, but also the righteous work that both of you apply in the various domains in which you work. I'm a Marylander, born and bred, which is a little bit unusual for rabbis to be serving and certainly in Reform rabbis, where we get sort of dispersed throughout the land after we graduate seminary. So it's a little bit unusual, and I say very special to me that I'm have the blessing to serve a community in Maryland. I didn't grow up, as you noted, in Hagerstown. Hagerstown has a relatively small Jewish population. I grew up in a much more dense population in Montgomery County with a much larger synagogue. And I grew up actually conservative, and I went to a Jewish day school that had Orthodox, conservative, and Reformed Jews all together in that setting, a really interdenominational place where Jews could learn, grow, and become friends together, actually, even despite their various religious backgrounds. So it was a really nice experience growing up. I went to public high school and found myself at Swarthmore College, a wonderful place to learn and to be challenged. And through that journey, I really began to explore my own religious identity through a more historical, critical lens. Also got the opportunity to meet and be friends, deep friends, loving friends with people from all sorts of different faith backgrounds. And then after that, I actually went into management consulting for a number of years. And during that time, 9/11 happened. I happened to be working in the downtown corridor of New York City, and I still spent quite a bit of time in Washington, both for work and where my family still lived, and not outside of Washington, where my in Maryland, where my family still lives, my parents, and I saw through that terrible time of such sorrow and such tragedy, people turn towards religion and religious settings and religious domains and religious narrative to heal, to support, to help one another. And we as Americans and as Jews and as good-natured people, I think we find ourselves in this time of difficulty, find ways to support one another in those settings. And so it was a very, in a way, difficult time, but also inspiring time. And ultimately, it did lead me to the rabbinate, because I felt moved to try and work in a multi-faith setting to try and advance issues of love in our society and helping to promote that sense of moderation in a world of extremism. But also at the individual level, I love being invited to be touched by people's lives, to be honored into that sacred, intimate space, and to help and guide people to alternatives that may be meaningful in their relationships through difficulty, through challenge, through transition, and helping them to help one another and to empower them to do so. It's really that personal aspect of my rabbinate, pastorally, which I find so meaningful. And the fact that it is, in some ways, I don't necessarily see a separation between the private sphere sometimes and the communal sphere, where we need to be doing a lot more to take care of one another.
Michael, I have a question about is it misunderstanding that drives the fear of we have a lot of different kinds of faith. For example, we have certain what do you want to call it? Tendencies within the Christian religion, for example, that are that assert that anybody else's faith is they're headed to hell. Period. You know, without any ambiguity at all, and they adopt a kind of thing. Well, we need to rewrite the Constitution of the United States, actually, to make it clear that this is a Christian nation. This is a we're going to be. A very dogmatic view, right, that ought to be just asserted over all of society. And, of course, we've heard this similar kind of thing coming from certain factions or trends or tendencies within the Islamic faith, okay, as well. And I suppose also within the Jewish faith as well, that there's a separatist set thee apart kind of thing within the religious communities. That's not the only tendency. I mean, there's also a very strong alternate tendency that sounds more like what you just said, actually. But how do we explain the fact that we have two different things going on? And probably, I don't know about every faith, but certainly in a number of them.
Well, I guess I'd begin by just stating what might be obvious, but it's worth to name, which is that this understanding of particularism or this relationship of us versus them, it's certainly not immune to any of our faith traditions. We all have a dimension of that within us. And by the way, there are aspects to that which are good. It's not all necessarily leads to a dark place. But it's not also exclusive, that understanding of particularism or exclusivity or of otherness. That's not a domain that's relative to any one faith tradition. It's also not, it's not something that can be reduced to any one group.
Right.
Groups as a whole, by definition of being groups, define themselves by certain boundaries and understanding of group identities or collectives. So it is a challenge. Now, when we ask ourselves, what is the source of those divisions? One could say that a beginning place of that is that it may come, if we look at it from a constructive way, of us enjoying, loving, and being a family together, to know that we share things together that separate and unite us through our experiences, through our beliefs, through our ethics, through our time together, through the stories that we share that are ours as a family.
Right. Or as a faith community.
Or as a faith community, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
As a faith community, one could even say as a state, as a city, as any group. And then there are tendencies when we become afraid or vulnerable, where we turn inwards, and rather than looking at ourselves for how we can grow, for what we can contribute, for where we can repair our own selves and heal our own selves, where we want to instead blame others or avoid issues, and that's challenging. And certainly, God's work is for us to take care of the vulnerable. We're commanded to do so, and it can be difficult when we are in pain to turn onto ourselves or to help someone else. That's a very sensitive time. And then I will also add is that there are, unfortunately, individuals, actors, and agendas that seek to divide us. And if we don't acknowledge the pain and vulnerability and weaknesses within us, then if we don't do that hard work, then those mechanisms that seek to create division will ultimately win. So it's very important that we really work on ourselves and on the healing. But I think the pain and the suffering that all of us experience, both as individuals and as groups, is a large source that lends itself to some of the challenges of otherness or of pitting ourselves against one another, unfortunately.
Now, as a, you know, my wife's an economist, okay, and so we're not. Sometimes we engage in a little bit of economic determinism here in our discussions at home. but you, I want to address the question of pain. Okay, so I mean, there's lots of different kinds of pain, and I'm, and of course, every life in, I'm sure, every era of history involves some pain. But is there a sense that when the changes in sort of aggregate pain, I don't know, that's an expression I just made up, okay, right there, but in other words, you have times like the Great Depression, okay, or actually, you know, in a way, right now, with this kind of aggravated inequality you have, where you, Carol and I, my wife, we call it the scrambling for crumbs economy, okay, for so many people, right? And that there incurs a certain fear, and then that question of the otherness. So for example, a single act of discrimination, someone in your parish, for instance, or that you know, says they were denied a job, or they were fired, or they were some other act, you know, some harmful act, and now by some other group or by somebody, and the word, some word, some insult, some ugly, inhuman kind of attitude is expressed towards some other group. And is that, are we talking about something that's kind of historical? I mean, it's always there to a certain degree, but it seems aggravated now. I mean, and so let's talk about the pain a little bit more.
I have studied quite a bit of history, and I know a little bit about the human condition, but my area of expertise really comes from my own faith background, which is both a lived experience of walking with people of faith, Jewish and non-Jewish, and also looking at the Bible and what my faith tradition and heritage and what it teaches. What I'd say is that we learn an interesting example. I love that, by the way. What'd you call it? An economy of crumbs?
Yeah, scrambling for crumbs.
So,
yeah.
When we look at times of absolute destruction and desolation and depravity in the Bible, there's many places where we can turn, which first of all suggests to us that we are not living in an entirely ahistorical condition.
Right.
But one of the earliest stories in the Bible that I'm sure we're all familiar with is the story of Noah. And it says that Noah was righteous in his generation, meaning that in a place where there is no person who is acting like a human being, like a mensch, like a good person, that we are called upon to be good people. And so when we feel surrounded by a society of an economy, sometimes where we perceive of crumbs, Noah, we ask, why was he chosen at that time to build the ark? Why Noah? And there are many responses to this. Judaism has a large tradition of us trying to explain or understand or hear one another. But one of the aspects of that story that I find most revealing to answer, or to maybe not answer, but to maybe to pursue the question, is it says that one of the commentaries says that Noah was asked to undertake that pursuit, and that he ended up being awake all throughout the night. Could you imagine how many? I have horses, okay? I have dogs. I have cats. I live on a sort of a. My wife accuses me of believing that I live on a petting zoo. So we have all these animals, and it's a constant activity, right, to take care of them. I mean, they get sick, they need help, they need to be fed, not to mention the animals that I also call myself, my wife, my children, and anyone who comes into my life. You know, all these creatures, not to mention the land, are all in need of our care. It's an enormous activity. It's a job on top of a job. Well, Noah, with all the creatures of the ark, he had a tremendous job. And one time, it says, as he was feeding a wild beast, I can't remember at the time whether it's a lion or a tiger, but it's our tradition suggests that he was bitten. I mean, these creatures aren't always kind to us. They have their own issues, as we all do. And sources of frustration, anxiety, and we act out when we're in pain and in fear. So do the animals. And Noah had to take care of all these animals in such a loving and caring and compassionate way through an enduring process where there must have been a sense of concern of what would happen and how would he and would he have enough resources? We're talking about economies of scale, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know, would there be enough resources? Would he even be able to be up to the task? I mean, so my tradition speaks to the fact that there has to be, very much as you're suggesting, there has to be, for leadership, we shouldn't think, because remember, he's the, again, I'll just repeat it, he's the righteous of a generation where he felt sort of uniquely prepared, and I think it takes courage. I think it takes believing that each one of us can make a difference, and believing that compassion and how we treat one another, whether it's the creatures of the earth, including one another, that is a response to these calamities that we face. But it is a more we hope we live in a better time than Noah, certainly. I believe that we do, but we still have a lot to learn as humanity about how to take care of one another.
Here's a thought. For example, I've heard the expression recently, nationalism. I've heard white nationalism expressed recently. I've heard economic nationalism expressed recently. And yet, here we are in the middle of a world that is becoming increasingly, and I personally am sure, unreversibly international and global in its connections. In other words, you're not going to be able to live your life and not go down the street and see a lot of people different than you, or go to a workplace and not have to cooperate and work with people that have different traditions and different backgrounds with you. And you're going to have to figure out a way to think differently, perhaps, about matters. For example, I remember when I first went to work for Netscape back in whatever it was in the mid-90s, and you know, we had I'll use the vernacular here. There was a number of redneck programmers that we that we had that had come from different places, and they were incapable, really, of working effectively together with, for example, the Indian and Asian individuals that were well trained came in and started to work, and more women that came in, and certain, and they just had a problem in terms of the workplace, because we were in software, right? It wasn't one of those situations where there was some boss standing over you every day like on an assembly line. It was a different kind of environment. It required you to voluntarily participate, to use your creativity in some constructive way, and so the companies, which before had kind of an agnostic policy on this kind of thing, gradually the software companies, anyway, that I worked for, including Microsoft, Bill Gates in particular, he says, we can't do this. You know, we have to be able to have a situation in which people can work together, all right? And we're going to recruit from all over the world. I remember when Microsoft established, for example, a major research institute in Israel, which I went over and visited a couple of times. And then there was this big exchange of folks that came back over here and over there, and then they set up one in China as part of a deal, because I think the deal was that China had stolen about a couple of billion dollars worth of Microsoft software and reverse engineered it, and in exchange, and the premier of China, or the whatever the top guy was, and he was coming over to see Bush, and before he saw Bush, he stopped and saw Bill Gates and said, look, I'm going to pay you $1 billion for the stolen software if you build a research institute in China. Mm-hmm. And Bill said, fine, you know, that's what I'll do. And so there is, even in the corporate culture, okay, in some areas, right, we're seeing, you know, one thing, but, you know, we now have this that's set off against, look at the split now between California and parts of the rest of this country. But is that the direction, is it to be like California? Is that where we should go in that sense? Is that helpful, or is that just a diversion?
Again, I think we have to be very careful here, because We live in a land of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and also a land that lifts up freedom of assembly and freedom right. of religion, and our ability to speak our conscience and to organize according to our conscience. And we have to do more to remind ourselves how to teach, celebrate, and dignify all of us. You know, I'm working on a project right now called the Thomas Kennedy Center. Thomas Kennedy was a heroic figure that fought against religious persecution. Jews were discriminated against in many ways in the society, as we all know. But even after the Bill of Rights in the state of Maryland and many other states, Jews were prohibited from serving in elected office in the state because there were actual religious oath tests that right. were written into the state constitutions. And Thomas Kennedy, a Presbyterian, a Christian, who it's said that he, at that point in time, when he took up this, what was called the Jew Bill, to reform the assembly right. in such a way that...
The oath, whatever. In particular, I take it, right?
What's that?
To change the oath, for example.
To change the oath, to reform it so Jews could participate fully as equal citizens in the society. By the way, it was introduced in, I think it was 1818, and didn't actually pass until 1826 after many attempts of failure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be able to recognize that heroic effort that he undertook... And to ask ourselves, how can all of us, all of our children, celebrate, learn from, acknowledge, and address that legacy in the world that we live in is incredibly important. And I think we have to do more of that. One other thought that comes to mind is, and trying to answer your question maybe... I'm not a political scientist, but to try and embrace some of your language, I'm a little bit hesitant to do so. But, you know, if we think of ourselves as all trying to embrace a world of pluralism, or at least of liberty,
yeah.
which is the cornerstone of America, I think we have to be careful to suggest that people who are religious exclusionaries, religious extremists, or extremists in general, those can be divisive factors that pull away or tear us away from the fabric of what we're trying to achieve. But to be a religious exclusionist, to saying that I exclusively believe that my way is the right way, can that coexist with a world of political pluralism? The answer to that, actually, I believe, is yes. Those two can coincide. Now, naturally, those of us who are probably consider religious pluralists are probably naturally inclined to see the value of political pluralism.
Right.
There might be a more of a parallel.
Yeah.
But you can believe in the exclusivity of your faith, and so long as you're participating in a civil way,
right.
with respect and dignity for all, I think one can still lift up and embrace these larger and deeper values of America and of the world that we're seeking. And so the question is, I for myself, maybe for other people of faith, what can we do, like the Thomas Kennedy Project, like other civil mechanisms, other spaces that we can create that challenge this alternative of discord and divisiveness and hate that will otherwise consume us? Because ultimately, creating those spaces and those languages and those places and times can be sources of healing, of understanding, of hearing. And otherwise, the lack of them sends us down a difficult path, I think.
That's for sure. I don't know, Dr. McGill, you
Yeah, I have a couple thoughts. One thing that occurred to me was that we're witnessing strains of fanaticism, it seems, in many religions. And what I observed, because I have a Christian background, I migrated from the Episcopal Church as a kid to the Quaker faith. And what I'm observing online, on social media, among progressive Christians is this, the idea that if the Christians are admonished to love their neighbor, that there's an absolute there, and that it really grates on progressive Christians, the idea that any fanaticism or exclusivity infringes upon that basic tenet, and how that gets reconciled seemingly with certain fanatical exclusivist Christian sects
or tendencies, whatever, tendencies, yeah, right,
yeah.
The Southern Baptists, for example, right, which are, yeah, right.
Well, there are. I mean, within all the, we have to be careful. Also, you know, you mentioned the Southern Baptists as an example. Again, even with,
well, their leadership. Let me put it that way. Okay. Their leadership. So, I mean, let me just put it that
denominational,
way.
Denominational, even within denominations, and even within leaderships, there's more than one. You know, my tradition says that there are two Jews and three opinions.
Yeah, right. Well,
and you know, and we
actually, I used to work for an Israeli company, so that is true. It was amazing. We used to make unbelievable progress despite that. It was really, we got software written and projects done even with that kind of. That was cool.
I suspect you haven't been to a Quaker threshing set. I'd say 20 Quakers, 100 opinions.
Uh-huh, yeah, similar. And our ancient traditions actually encourage that type of spirited debate. But there is a difference, and I just want to be clear, is to say, of course, I condemn, you know, hateful acts of as a Jew, as an American, as a rabbi, I condemn the hateful acts of bigotry, of racism, of course, of anti-Semitism. I mean, and we have to be careful to ask what is hateful and what is not. But the Bible commands us to take care of the orphan, the poor, the widow, to love thy neighbor as thyself, ahavta re'echa kamocha. That expression, which is invoked both in the New Testament and in the Torah or the Old Testament, yes, that is sacred language, and that is exactly the language that we need, all of us, progressives, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, people of the tapestry of faith, to remind ourselves what are our basic principles. One thing I've mentioned lately is e pluribus unum. Out of many, one, and I've just said, if we're not careful, we're going to have e pluribus nothingness. and love thy neighbor, and the understanding of a golden rule. These are threads through the tapestry of faith, and so I think it's incredibly important. And I commend those progressives that are, in an earnest way, are invoking their faith tradition to have that conversation. Now, on the other "quote unquote" side of exclusion, they will also claim similar language, and so, but there's a beginning point, a light, a source by which to have a constructive conversation. And we people of faith, in a world of secularism, in a world lacking in community, I mean, how many Americans really forget love thy neighbor, even know their neighbor, even know who their neighbor is? I mean, and we have people of faith and faith communities who are attending services regularly, who are invested in a faith community, not just of belief, but they're actually living that life. And I'm not judging somebody in terms of their frequency of participation or how they're living that life. I'm just saying those of us who are invested in some form of a faith community, we have a relationship to one another. I'm not just a rabbi by the way of and I shouldn't say just, I'm very proud, obviously, to be the rabbi of Hagerstown, of my congregation, the only congregation, Jewish congregation in Washington County. But I'm also the president, actually being put into office today, as the president of the Hagerstown Area Religious Council, which is 35 faith communities as a part of that. And they're all diverse. But there is something that we share together across those divides. And that's where the source of commonality, of fellowship, and of love exists.
I was going to ask you, have there been incidents of what we might call hate activity in Hagerstown, in the area?
Yes.
And how has the, since you're, what's the name of the coalition of
Hagerstown Area Religious Council?
How did they respond to that? Or did it come up? Or was it a subject?
Sure. Yeah. And not just the Hagerstown Area Religious Council. There are other faith groups in Hagerstown who I'm friends with,
right,
but are not same members of that particular group for whatever reasons, historically, whatever. That when there is an act of hate, the religious community is often called upon. Sometimes it's about putting out a statement, which we have done. We've mm-hmm. put out a statement of peace that's been adopted by the, all of the faith communities. And we have over, I can't remember at this point, maybe 700, 800 signatures on it. It's quite an impressive thing. And we try and teach it.
That's interesting.
Share it. We put out other faiths when particular incidents occur. And most importantly, I would say, is that when there is division or fraction, just as there would be between a pastor or a rabbi or imam and their church, their synagogue or their mosque, sometimes the best way of addressing it is not in the spotlight, but to right. be able to have private conversations that actually lead to repair. And we do a whole heck of a lot of that. And that's a lot of activity. So even if I can't resolve an issue or work towards repair, there's another faith community leader who probably can, based on different gifts or coming from a different person, vice versa. And the nice thing is that just as we, in our faith communities internally, try and create these communities of trust, it's important that religious leadership
right.
and people across faith communities also can develop that as well. That it's not just something, oh, we're all agreed on these principles or these ethics or this is my book and I'm attached to, or these are my rites and rituals, but that through our lived experiences together that we have obligations and a language that we can build upon to help and support one another. So the answer is yes, there are acts of hate that occur to individuals and to communities, but we find ways to help and support one another.
Do you think that, I mean, for example, I've been reading this series of, they weren't written in World War II. They're about the lead up to World War II. Alan First, he's a great, he's a spy novelist, but he writes novels almost exclusively about the period from like 1935 to 1942. Mm-hmm. And he is mostly situated in a number of different European and Eastern European countries. Okay. and he tells the story pretty much. Each novel is sort of starts from a different point, one in Spain, one in Poland, one in here, one in there, you know, and all observing this this movement toward catastrophe, right, that is taking place, obviously taking place in the middle of a Great Depression as well, okay, that affected Europe as well as here, the unraveling of community. He's a very interesting novelist. You might consider picking up one of his books. He's a recent guy, but he's obviously researched these things unbelievably. His name's Alan First. And so my sense right now is that, for the first time that I can think of in the American history, except unless you want to count the Confederacy era, you have, a fascist tendencies seizing the heights of power in the United States. And I think it's difficult to avoid that conclusion. Are they exactly the same as Mussolini, Hitler? No, no, but it's never the same, okay? But it's a authoritarian and based on very divisive ideologies that has taken the presidency and is in charge of about half the departments of the government right now. And so that and then and in the midst of that, there's all of a sudden all kinds of, you know, very Nazi type thing starts to come out, right, in the open and cover, and that has to create a lot of fear for people. And is the fear, is your sense is that the fear is increasing and that people are more afraid? Because I'm more afraid. I'm just wondering whether other people are too, and should that be grounds for, and what's the right response to that? I mean, is there a ways that we need to get closer? We need to somehow. What's your sense of that? And then while you're answering that question, I gotta go take care of a little bill out here. I'll be right back.
I think it's there are tendencies that are elements within politics right now that and the rhetoric and the language that is incredibly disturbing. I wouldn't name or attribute that to any one person, although I would just say that with the height of power comes solemn responsibility, almost unique responsibility, to care and be attentive to the sensitivities of all Americans, and to realize that some communities, because they both have more recent memories of very serious forms of oppression and vulnerability, and there are other communities that suffer from unbelievably unfair disadvantage in our society, that those communities are particularly vulnerable to divisive rhetoric and a community of us not loving one another. I think that what we can do has already been named. It's about, you know, this is really why, for me, I'm so incredibly devoted to the Thomas Kennedy Center project. Right. To say we have to do more at the individual level. I mean, what's beautiful about the Thomas Kennedy Project for a moment is to say that you have Christians and Jews, conservatives and liberals, artisans and business people, people across different walks of faith, rural communities, urban communities, Jews working across denominations or movements, all coming together to try and affirm and celebrate the heroic efforts. I'll also say that, you know, what has just occurred in Florida and in South Texas, no one asks when you're coming into a boat whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. We need to do a lot more of loving one another, of shalom one another with our language, with our action, of really demonstrating with the projects that we invest ourselves in, with our time, with our resources, you know, taking more seriously the acts of love and how vital faith communities are, and actions of faith and supporting people of faith, how important this is to the very basis of American of our freedoms,
right?
And we haven't we've underinvested in that. You know, it's sort of like I'll explain it in maybe a different way, in a personal way. So as I mentioned before, I live on a farm, and when my tractor breaks down, which happens. This actually
happens. They all break down eventually.
I mean, well, and I can't figure out how to get the thing to work again. And my wife is, you know, she's very concerned about the fields and the horses, and so I need to call upon my neighbors. And I'm not a wealthy man, and I need to, you know, I'm really in a position sometimes to be able to depend on my neighbors to help me out of a bind. And right now, it's sort of a strange image, right? A rabbi trying to fix a trailer in the middle of a field.
But, oh, I don't know. It's
and right now, the tractor of our land is broken, and we have this incredible opportunity to help one another, to support one another, and it's an individual acts of compassion, of caring, and a love, of teaching that ethic, of supporting one another in that ethic, regardless of a person's political persuasion, regardless of their religious affiliation. And doing so with dignity and respect. And these are everyday acts. Every moment is a sacred moment to demonstrate that we love one another. You know, we can all be Noah. We all are invited into demonstrating the love and acts of compassion of Jesus, of Adonai, of Allah. That's what we're called to do. That's the,
right.
These are our commandments. They're the basis by which we live our lives. And if we are going to take our sacred commitments seriously, you know, now is a good time to really start to walk the walk.
You know, back about 30 years ago when Shepherdstown was trying to figure out how they could, most of the churches were much smaller than they are now. Mm-hmm. Shepherdstown was smaller. They were trying to figure out how to put together a Christmas, event that might, this is amongst the Christian churches, okay, right now, different denominations. And they formed the Shepherdstown Ministerial Association, you know, to do this. And of course, but almost immediately, there was a fundamentalist trend that refused to participate, mm-hmm. okay, and still refused to participate, because they thought the whole idea of that kind of collaboration was some sort of pollution of some sort. I don't know.
Heresy.
And like, for example, when Randy put out the good newspaper, Randy Tremba, the Presbyterian guy, they said, well, you shouldn't call it a good newspaper because that's reserved only for this. Good news is a phrase mm-hmm. only to be associated with sayings of Jesus Christ or something like that, you know. And so they have, to this day, you know, we've only, I think we only achieved one of the so-called fundamentalist churches that would participate, you know, in the Ministerial Association, and the two big ones, Crossroads and the one out there on Route 230 there. I can't remember the name of that big one. They would not. They never have. And do you have that kind of, is that kind of division in Hagerstown? Or have you overcome that one?
Yes and no. I mean, we have some of those faith communities that participate. We have others that participate with us, and we work together on shared objectives, shared goals, and shared statements. And then there's no one response to that. Meaning these different communities, is it a challenge? Yes, but it's also a challenge within the Ministerial Association to try and find consensus. I mean,
right.
I think as a Quaker from a Quaker tradition, I remember from my days in Swarthmore, we once got into a debate about how to arrive at consensus.
Right. Yes. Right. So, that's right. So, a sense of the meeting. That's what we call it. A sense of the meeting. Yes. Right.
These are challenges. So I would just offer that we're living in very. I don't think it's overly provocative or inflammatory or overstating the case to say that we're living in not just challenging times but dangerous times, and on that precipice of danger, to pull away from that and to say, okay, well, if this language or this structure or this mechanism or this history doesn't help us to come together, what can we do to find ways to support one another. And certainly, I can't imagine. I mean, of course, there are exceptions to it, but overwhelmingly, I have to believe that the churches, the synagogues, the mosques that are helping people out in Florida and Texas right now are working together, are collaborating together, and doing so with the civil authorities and the Red Cross. Right. So, I mean, I guess we sometimes wait till the storm is literally upon us before we sometimes take action as Americans. Well, I think there are different types of storms, and there's different types of water rising, and sometimes the stories of the Bible, like Noah, are trying to teach us not only about the natural elements within us, which we are beginning to experience, but also spiritually, religiously, politically, what are those storms and how do we treat one another?
We got about time for one more question if we're going to get Ari back to Hagerstown in time. So go ahead, Dr. McGill.
I just want to segue a little bit. As a doctor, as a clinician, and as someone who absolutely considers myself an agnostic about religion, I'm always fascinated with the literature on faith and wellness. And I had the opportunity to go to a workshop at the Gallup Organization in D.C. about 5 years ago on the subject of the benefits of religion. Now, this was an extensive research going on over 10, 15 years. Five scientists, all of whom described themselves as either atheists or agnostics, who said that they could not ignore the fact that there seemed to be some benefit, some mysterious benefit from belonging to a faith community. And it did not matter whether it was
Christian, that's interesting,
Jew,
yeah.
Sikh, Muslim. The takeaway for me was when the Asian scientist, a young Asian scientist from Salt Lake City, the university there, said that the research, the data was so compelling that he, who never has attended a church, if he got a diagnosis of cancer, the very next Sunday he would find
that's great.
Now here's the other point. It's not only belonging to a faith community, but it's also crucial that you have a friend, that you have cultivated at least one friendship within that faith community. And now they controlled for all sorts of social organization. The Rotary, the Shriners, it does not have the same effect. To belong to a faith community and have at least one friend, intimate friend in that body, is somehow determinant of a higher state of well-being and health.
But man was not, man and woman were not created to be alone. This is the basis of the story of Adam and Eve. It's the basis of the understanding of Abraham, the story of the Bible, of how it unfolds. It's a story of a family and how that family grows and has obligations and supports and has, yes, has challenges, has a lot of pain that they cause each other, but the stories of a family and how that emerges. Maybe one reason for this, from my own faith tradition, is a lot of times when we're going through pain, we have a tendency to ask why. Why is this happening to me? Why am I going through this? And religion provides purpose, provides direction, but it also provides the hows, the whats. You know, if somebody is going through a mourning process and has had a terrible tragedy, I could turn to so many examples, we don't have the time. But if somebody's going through a terrible time in their lives, I sometimes, in that moment, maybe years later,
there's an opportunity to turn back to that moment as a learning moment, as some where a new blessing or a new sense of ourselves was discovered through that sense of vulnerability or pain. But in that moment in time, that's not, you know, what can I learn from this moment right now? I mean, that's the people are in pain, and and to say, hey, you know, just come to shul, you know, like here you can you can come here and you're obligated to come here to say the Kaddish, the morning prayer, for somebody who's grieving, to acknowledge the gifts that person gave you, to understand that by coming together you're obligated to be, to not be isolated anymore, for people to surround you, for people to provide that sense of comfort or that sense of, you know, the world is a crazy place, to reinforce a sense of calendar, of structure, of familiarity, of language, of prayers, of people, and to look out for one another, that the caring there is real. There's an attachment that you share, and how terrible it would be to be alone and to feel disconnected when you're already in so much pain. Usually it's not. Yes, the immediate source of pain is always profoundly difficult, but it's the anxiety and the frustration and the uncertainty and all the emotions that build upon that source of pain that are natural to human condition that exacerbate the suffering. And if I can't do anything about, I'd love to take away the source of the pain as a rabbi. I'd love to do that. I'm sure all of us would, as human beings, as a person, you know. But what can I do? But what I can do is help in those other areas.
Well, I think we got to bring this to a close, because otherwise you're not going to make it back in time. Yeah. Okay, so why don't we do that? I want to thank you so much, Ari Plos, Rabbi Ari Plos, for participating.
Doing, John.
And I'd like to hold some more series on this, get some more voices in on this, and make this an interesting series of programs that we're going to be trying to do on trying to explore how to repair some of the pain and move forward as communities here. I know that there's a lot of interest in this in our community, and there's also some serious issues going on as well that I think more discussion, you know, more sharing. I like that. I remember, you know, the huge breakthrough that took place. I was a veteran of the labor movement for many years, and I remember the huge breakthrough that took place once, you know, the certain unions, especially the auto workers, had decided to help sponsor prayer breakfasts on sometimes once a year with the African American community, for example, was a very important step, just to try and do something different, right? And to have a sharing of values, and so whatever, you know, whatever initiatives that can be taken to bring us together, or at least a better understanding and of each of our humanity, I think we all are obligated to take that path, because we don't know what's going to happen in the external world. I mean, we can be plagued by both political and natural disasters of every kind, and a lot of times it seems way beyond us in our capacities, and something too big for us to even deal with. But we do have friends and families and communities here close by that must be the source of our strength. At least in the immediate areas of trying to help people. Thank you so much for participating today, Ari, and look forward to talking to you again. We'll try to get this this little pattern going here. I think it's an important way to develop the Quakers call it, the sense of the meeting, right? Now, you mentioned when you opened up about taking an oath, you know, the Quakers have a more profound problem. They're not supposed to take any oath of any kind. Okay, so we had to get some exceptions at times so we can affirm without taking an oath. that was the workaround.
There's a reason that Pennsylvania is such a tolerant beacon for so many.
That's true. That's true.
I'm a Pennsylvanian, and I like to say that, you know, Pennsylvania was the only of the original colonies that accepted all religions. Every other colony had some exclusion.
Really?
Is that true also, just out of curiosity, I just don't know the history, is that also true Rhode Island? Rhode Island have also?
I think they did, yeah.
Yeah, so Rhode Island would all. So Rhode Island and Rhode Island, Pennsylvania were probably
the most
tolerant,
the most. Right?
And Massachusetts, which today is probably one of the more liberal states, started out as the only one with a state religion, right? Was right, the exactly. The what's up with
the Puritans?
No, they had it was the
which is another.
Can't remember the name of them.
How, the oppressed can become the oppressor.
It can't happen. That's so easy. It seems that's impossible, but it can happen, right? Well, thank you so much. All right, thank you, Dr. McGill. Okay, we're going to bring this to a close. This we'll catch this on the podcast coming up here for later today. And thank you guys so much. We'll go back to what's going to play next. We got Nancy Wilson, a concert live from way back.